From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, President Trump said he was by far the most transparent president and his the most transparent administration in the history of the United States. And he tweeted that he allowed everyone to testify to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation, including his White House counsel. That would be Don McGahn, who notably told Mueller that he ignored Trump's order to fire him, possibly saving Trump from an obstruction charge.
But then the president called further subpoenas by congressional Democrats for his financial records ridiculous and vowed to fight them. Let's bring in our political strategist today. It's Maria Cardona, Democratic strategist. Hi, Maria.
Hey, Jeremy. Hey, Robin.
Hi.
And John Brabender is with us as well, Republican strategist. Hi, John.
Hello.
So, John, do you think it's a wise move for the president to block his aides from testifying to congressional Democrats? Don't you want to hear from Don McGahn and others?
Well, I think I would first say I do think it's wrong strategically, but I also think it's remarkably understandable. I mean, the Democrats have to start feeling a lot like Charlie Brown, who's about to kick the football and it keeps being pulled away. Every time we feel we finally have Trump, we've got him. And now the Mueller report comes out and we find out that they didn't have him. Yet they're going to try to keep going down this rabbit hole. And if I was the president, or if I was anybody who was wrongly accused over and over again, at some point you feel like you have to take a stand and start fighting back. I think that's what the president's doing. But I do think it takes him off message from things that the American people really want to talk about.
Maria, what do you think about that? And you know, this also goes to the issue of the tax returns, where there's an actual law that says that they shall furnish the tax returns. And they're saying no to that as well.
So clearly I have a different view than my friend John.
Shocking.
Right. And that is that the Mueller report did nothing of the sort in terms of exonerating Trump. And yes, Mueller did not bring charges, but it is so damning the fact that the only reason he did not bring charges was because of the guidelines from the Justice Department that said you cannot indict a sitting president. In fact, Mueller lays out a devastating case that, you know, from 10 to 12 cases, instances where Donald Trump sought to obstruct justice. And it is clearly a framework and a map that he gave over to Congress for them to follow their responsibilities of oversight, which is exactly what they are doing and which is exactly what they should be doing. And it's exactly what the American people elected them to do.
Yeah, but let me weigh in if I could. So what we're really saying is we all agree the president was found innocent on collusion. No collusion. We all agree on that.
Well, actually, I don't agree on that.
Well,
but, okay.
but that's what the report said. That's what Mueller said. I think that's indisputable. Yet what we're trying to somehow say is the president tried to stop the very investigation that ultimately proved he was innocent on collusion. And what they cite is that a conversation he had with Don McGahn making a recommendation that Mueller had a conflict. And Don McGahn said, I can't do that because he's his attorney. And that's what he decided to do. But the president didn't fired Don McGahn and said, I'm going to get somebody who will. He filed his general counsel's advice.
Well, he's fired him now. John, I just want to jump in and say, that, yes, but as we said last week when we were all talking about this, the collusion was not what the report was looking for. They were looking for a conspiracy.
Right.
They couldn't find the conspiracy, but there's really a damning list of contacts with Russians and definitely Russian interference in the election. And the report also said that they could not, if they could clear him of obstruction, they would have done so. They couldn't do that. Maria, you know, the sense is there a lot are saying, the analysts are saying that the sense is that Mueller wanted Congress to pick this up.
Right.
And William Barr intercepted that throw. But it doesn't Donald Trump even have a point? He's starting to talk about issues like infrastructure, like lowering drug prices. If the if the Democrats get into this, what could be a quagmire for them, they may not be able to talk about those issues up to the election.
Well, a couple of things here, Robin. First of all, the president has said he is talking about infrastructure since the first time we had Infrastructure Week, which was probably 2 years ago. But the fact is, just look at the president's Twitter feed. Oh, my goodness. He's tweeted more than 50 times in the last 24 hours. None of it was about infrastructure. So it's ludicrous to say, oh, the president wants to talk about the things that the American people care about. That's just baloney, because the president is afraid of what could become an impeachment an impeachment process. And that is not far from where this could lead us. But I think the Democrats are being very smart in following the roadmap that Mueller gave them in terms of bringing in McGahn to testify, bringing in Mueller to testify. Because while I think the majority of Democrats and many, many American voters believe that there are grounds for impeachment even now, we have to bring the public with us. And when you have people that are going to be speaking directly in person and in their own voice about exactly what the Mueller report laid out, that is going to be incredibly damning to this administration, which is why he is fighting this tooth and nail now.
I guess now we are able to just say damning left, right, and center on NPR, because that's what that's the way people are describing the Mueller report. But listen, let me ask you this, John. We know that you and many Democrats even would say that impeachment is not politically wise for the Democrats. But do you think that this would be impeachable? What you've seen is impeachable. You know, Clinton was impeached in part for obstruction of justice. Nixon probably would have been if he hadn't resigned.
Yeah. Look, what I've seen, and again, I'm looking at this through the context of a Republican media consultant. Now, I do not see what evidently people on the other side of the aisle seem to see. But I will say this. I don't think Nancy Pelosi is going to let this go anywhere near it in the House. I think she'll say, oh, yes, we need to ask these questions and so forth. The problem the Democrats have, though, is Nancy Pelosi will not be running the messaging. It'll be the 20 candidates running for president who will be the real message of the Democrat Party. And they seem to be wanting to try to one-up each other on calling for impeachment. And I think that's a huge political problem for the Democrats.
Marie, we're going to get to the candidates in a second. But I do want to ask you about impeachment, because we're hearing, what has seemed to have happened here is that, yes, Mueller laid out 10 incidents, I think, of a possible obstruction that the president was prevented from doing by the people around him. There were, all the contacts with Russians. And yes, there are Democrats who want to take a look at that. But if they do, again, it's the same as, having the hearings. If they do, does it take them off message going to 2020? Is it a trap?
Not necessarily. And again, the political ramifications of impeachment goes both ways. We shouldn't embark on an impeachment process simply because we believe that Trump is unfit to be president. We need to go where the facts take us. We also shouldn't not proceed with impeachment proceedings because we believe it will be damaging to the party. This is a constitutionally required responsibility for the Democrats. When the Republicans had the House, they chose to look the other way on the actions of this most corrupt administration that we have had in a generation. That's fine. That's why they lost the House. One of the reasons why the American people elected Democrats is to be a check on the president, because there was none. Mm-hmm. And there might be people like John and others in the Republican Party who believe that telling your lawyer to lie to the American people or to try to fire Mueller, the special counsel, and then lie about that, maybe they think that's okay, but that is not okay. And it is specifically not a good behavior from the president of the United States.
So are you throwing Bernie Sanders into that same category? Because I believe
Bernie Sanders is not president of the United States.
But no. He's come out against going forward with impeachment. So I guess Bernie Sanders has now joined the Republicans.
Bernie Sanders is not the head of the Democratic Party. Neither is Elizabeth Warren. Neither are Kamala Harris.
Who is the head of the Democrat Party?
This is a process that is going on.
Is it AOC?
AOC is not the head of the Democrat Party.
Okay.
Well, given that we don't have the presidency right now, the people who are looking for what you're saying as the head of the Democratic Party is Nancy Pelosi. And she is very good on where we need to be going.
Okay.
And so that's where we're taking our
In the last minute or so that we have left, I want to ask about one other thing, and that involves 2020. Of course, we're waiting for Joe Biden to make his announcement potentially tomorrow that he's going to get into the race. But one of the candidates who's in the race right now and has been getting a lot of headlines is Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He has come under scrutiny for demoting the city's first black police chief for improperly taping white officers' phone calls that he claims were racist. Here's Buttigieg at a CNN town hall Monday night.
I was, frankly, a little bit slow to understand just how much anguish underlay the community's response to this. Because for people in the community, it wasn't just about whether
so
we were right or
he's
wrong.
He's responding to this. Maria, my question to you is, are Democrats holding their candidates to an unsustainable purity test that we are spending so much time talking about a police chief that nobody before this week had ever heard of outside of South Bend?
Well, I don't think we're spending so much time on it. I think he got like one question on it right now. And so, but this is the point that I want to make. Republicans will jump on any opportunity to criticize the 2020 candidates and say, oh, look what so-and-so said. They must be the head of the Democratic Party. That's where Democrats are going. No, this is part of the process, people in America. It is a very healthy process to have. Every candidate will have the issues that they will have to answer for. That is exactly what the Democratic primary process is for. And at the end of it, especially given we have 20 candidates, the person who emerges is going to be the strongest president to take out.
Thanks to both of you.
Maria Cardona, John Brabender, thank you.
Today, the Supreme Court sided with employers in a 5-4 ruling on class action lawsuits, saying there can't be a class action unless the employer specifically agrees to it in a contract, which seldom happens. The court also heard oral arguments today, and it has been a busy week at the High Court. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg has been there and joins us now. Hi, Nina.
Hi, Jeremy.
So yesterday, the justices argued about one of this term's biggest cases, which looks at whether the Trump administration can add a question about citizenship on the 2020 census. Tell us what happened in court.
Well, this was a pretty stark oral argument with the court's five conservatives appearing completely unconcerned about the controversy that has swirled around adding the citizenship question, and none of them ever expressing any doubt about the addition of the question. And the court's four liberals, to one degree or another, being incensed about the addition of the question. Justice Kagan said that the record, you couldn't read the record without coming to the conclusion that the justifications for adding the question are contrived. So that was sort of the lay of the land. Justice Kavanaugh and even Justice Gorsuch did something that conservatives almost never do. They went to look to international law to justify the addition of the question. Mm. Justice Kavanaugh noted that, for example, that the United Nations recommends that a citizenship question be included in the census, and Gorsuch pointed to that too. Now, this is normally considered a big no-no by conservatives, but that gives you some idea of the degree to which conservatives were willing to basically ignore the complaints of the dozens of states and counties and cities that have said adding the question would lead to an undercount.
And yeah, the fear here on the part of those who don't want this question added is that if you ask a question about citizenship, that many Latino households or even many undocumented immigrants will not answer the census, will not respond to the census, and then you'll have an undercount across the board. Now, Justice Sotomayor apparently was very vocal about her opposition to this in court yesterday.
Yes, she said this was a solution in search of a problem. And she said there was no doubt that that Hispanic households would be hesitant, some of them, about filling out this form if they thought it might lead to the deportation of somebody who lived in the house or even a friend. I mean, and the Census Bureau's own data has shown that. Typically, this kind of a question is road tested beforehand. It wasn't road tested in this case. But they did do some focus groups to see how various immigrant groups reacted. And the answer is not well. One group, who were actually Vietnamese, got up and just left when the subject of citizenship came up in the focus group.
Okay, so this may end up being a 5-4 conservatives versus liberals decision. We'll see when that comes in June. The other thing I want to ask you about is that the Supreme Court on Monday agreed to take three cases involving LGBTQ employment discrimination in the fall term. Tell us more about that.
Well, this all involves whether the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Civil Rights Act in employment, covers the LGBT community. Now, nobody thinks that back in 1964, Congress was passing a law that bars discrimination against gays and lesbians. But the language of the law is extremely broad. It bans discrimination based on sex. And the Supreme Court, in a number of its opinions subsequently, has said that you can't fire people based on stereotypical views of them. Lots of states do have laws that ban the firing of LGBT community members, but there is no such law on the books in the federal government except for the 1964 law. So the question here that the court's going to resolve next year is whether or not the 1964 law, the language of the law, which is extremely broad, allows people to fire gays and lesbians and in one case a transgender person because of their sexual orientation or because of their sexual status. And there are three cases that are up before the court that they agreed to review, and it's going to be one of the big cases of the term next year.
That's NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Nina, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now to the American Lung Association's State of the Air report released today. It found half of all Americans live in counties with unhealthy levels of air pollution. And that number's on the rise, with more days with hazardous air quality than ever from 2015 to 2017. Janice Nolan is lead author. And Janice, we know there's been a push for deregulation in this current administration, affecting the Clean Air Act, for instance. So maybe this isn't surprising?
Well, fortunately, some of the deregulation that's been proposed has not taken effect. The increase in unhealthy air that we're seeing is actually Mother Nature doing it to us through climate change, and that's why we raised that as a major issue in this report. When you have the years 2015, 16, and 17 that we're covering in this report labeled as the three hottest years in global history, and you see the impacts of the wildfires in 2017 out in California and other parts of the country on air quality in neighboring and long-distance communities, you can see the impact of needing to take more action. So while we're also fighting rollbacks, we're also urging more action to clean up the pollution, to deal with climate change as a major risk for us for public health.
Well, and maybe still encouraging people to change their behavior, because we were so fascinated to see that topping your list for worst year-round particle pollution is Fresno, California, the metro area there. Los Angeles remains a city with the worst ozone pollution, as it has for 19 years of the 20-year history of this report. Six of the country's 10 worst cities for air pollution are in California. But we know California has some of the strictest air pollution regulations and some of the most forward-thinking people. Is this simply the amount of people and the amount of cars, for instance?
That's a big factor. The number of people, the number of cars, the industry there, agriculture, shipping, transport of goods, all of those things play a big role. And the fact that much of the state has a nice little bowl in its topography so that air quality is trapped often in there and gets worse there. And they've known this for a long time, which is why they've taken some of the more aggressive steps. But theirs is so much worse than much of the rest of the country that they've helped us to develop tools that have been very effective nationwide. But again, it does show the need to continue to reduce pollution, because we still have a long way to go nationwide, not just in California.
Well, and we should say that, you know, some of the cities with the highest number of days with unhealthy spikes in this particle pollution that you've been looking for, you have Fairbanks, Alaska, Missoula, Montana, Bismarck, North Dakota. I'm surprised. What about New York or, you know, some of the East Coast cities with also congestion and a lot of people?
Well, you'll know New York ranks on our list of most polluted cities for ozone. In fact, New York in the Northeast is what we call sometimes the tailpipe of the nation. Mm. Emissions that are created in other parts of the country show up there. And in fact, the county in the metropolitan New York area that has the most ozone pollution is Fairfield County, Connecticut. And it actually has the worst ozone pollution in the whole eastern half of the country. And that's not because of what Fairfield is doing. It's because of the pollution that's blown into there from the Midwest, the Mid-Atlantic, from the New York metro area. And it just shows up in the monitors in Fairfield County. But it definitely shows that the nation has no barriers to ozone or particle pollution. They blow across the country, so we have to have national measures to reduce them.
It's also called smog, and we're reading that it's essentially it's a sunburn of the lung. Imagine how that feels. Where you can't, you have a hard time breathing. Who has the healthiest air? And again, it may not be behavior or industry. It may just be, you know, where they happen to be in the weather pattern. But who's the healthiest?
Well, we have six cities that had the cleanest air quality in them, and they had no days when their ozone levels or particle levels went above the to the unhealthy range, and they had the lowest year-round levels, includes places like Bangor, Maine, Burlington, Vermont, Honolulu, Hawaii, Lincoln, Nebraska, Palm Bay, Florida, and Wilmington, North Carolina. Some of those benefit because of their geography. Honolulu, you can blow a lot of pollution away easily, but also because their sources are not as significantly large as some other places are. So many of them have been on our cleanest cities list for a while.
You have a megaphone. you know, most of the problems, individuals, of course, can change behavior. We can fight climate change. But what is the thing that can be done immediately to start improving the air?
We're taking steps now. And one of the things we're asking people to do are to sign a petition to Congress and the administration about climate, that we need to take action to address climate. And there are things that are en route now that we're fighting and working to make sure stay in place, like the Clean Power Plan, like rules to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases from vehicles, rules to clean up emissions of things like methane from oil and gas extraction, things that have been in place for a while, and this administration is trying to roll them back. We're fighting that in every way we can to be able to keep those tools working and to get them actually implemented to be able to reduce the pollution that we're seeing.
Not go backwards. Janice Nolan, lead author of the American Lung Association State of the Air Report, will link you to all that information at herenow.org. Janice, thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. Ember Wave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018, learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave, control your comfort.
Now, some news from the world of travel that you'll hear about first on Here and Now. Consumers who want to avoid flying on Boeing MAX jets when the grounded planes are flying again might have a hard time doing that because some airline websites have stopped including that information on future flight listings. Joining us now with more on this is Seth Kaplan, Here and Now transportation analyst. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
So you were looking around on some airline websites to see what they were listing for future flights. What did you find?
Yeah, Jeremy, as you might know, for the next few months, there are no MAX flights scheduled. United has canceled them through July, American and Southwest through August. But we were able to look at airline schedule databases to see what's scheduled beyond that. And so looking in September, for example, if you searched for flights where you knew it was scheduled on a MAX, on American's site, it just simply didn't list an aircraft equipment type, whereas American typically does list that. On United's site, if it was a MAX flight, it said that it was a Boeing 737. But didn't list the specific kind, even though they typically do that. And in Southwest's case, it was listing a 737-800. So that's kind of the previous version of the MAX. It listed that rather than the MAX 8 that's actually scheduled.
So what did the airlines say when you asked them about this?
Yeah, American and United both explained that they were working on this and that it would quickly be fixed. In United's case, actually, by early Wednesday, if you looked at those same flights, it did indeed say in United's case that the flight would be operated by a 737 MAX 9, the plane that was indeed scheduled for that.
I mean, it's not surprising, I guess, that they wouldn't want to put that out there because you'd probably, if you are scared to fly on these planes, which a lot of people are, you would actively not book the flight that was on one of them in the future if you knew that it was going to be on a MAX.
Yeah, and Southwest, by the way, still hasn't replied to our inquiries. But yeah, the airlines said, and an American kind of walked me through this specifically, that this all started actually to eliminate confusion rather to cause it. They said back when the MAX was first grounded, these airline websites that provide this information were never designed with any of this in mind. It's designed so that, you know, looking at flights far in the future, you could see what kind of aircraft type you would be on if you cared about that. Most people in the past didn't. So when the MAX were grounded and American was kind of scrambling, canceling some flights, moving non-MAX planes onto other routes where MAX had been scheduled, consumers were confused because they would still see the MAX listed. It wasn't updating in real time. So they quickly kind of suppressed that information so that people would know, no, you're not going to be on a MAX. Yes, your flight is still operating. But then that kind of lingered, and here we are.
The company's CEO, Boeing's CEO, said today that the 737 MAX's return to service will be paced by global regulators and customers. Do we know when the plane might be flying again?
Well, if actions, as they say, speak louder than words, you can kind of look at what airlines are doing. And when you see them taking the MAX out of the schedule into July, into August in some cases, that tells you that they probably don't expect it to be flying before then because they would not want to do the same work twice. So they probably think they're being somewhat conservative and hoping right now that it'll be flying by about September.
And Boeing already taking a pretty big hit, earnings down 21% in the first quarter.
Yeah, they are. And they've suspended their financial guidance for the rest of the year. They just don't know what to predict in terms of finances at this point until they know what's happening in terms of getting MAX back in the air.
Seth Kaplan here now, transportation analyst. Thank you, Seth.
Ugh, seventh grade. It's hard enough. Now imagine you're uprooted from your big suburban middle school and relocated to a depressed rural town in Vermont with a seventh grade of just 11 kids who don't play by the social rules, don't have the latest fashion, or iPhones. Well, maybe what you do is reach for Homer's Odyssey. Now, goddess, child of Zeus, tell the old story for modern times. Find the beginning, which is what lead character Caitlin attempts to do in Ali Benjamin's new YA book, The Next Great Polly Fink, in which gods and goddesses are and reality share the stage, and a seventh grader falls from his pedestal. That would be the aforementioned Polly Fink. Ali Benjamin's debut novel was the award-winning The Thing About Jellyfish. Lots of buzz now for The Next Great Polly Fink, and Ali Benjamin joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And we understand that you actually found your seventh grade diaries.
That's true, and it was awful. It was awful.
Did they have a little lock on them?
No, it was a spiral notebook, and the pages were just filled with sort of my chicken scratch handwriting and drawings of unicorns and E.T. And I would write these little sidebars. My life is a soap opera. I didn't look at it for 30 years, and then my mom moved out of my childhood home, and I got a box of stuff, and at the bottom of it was this diary that I had kept. And I really thought I was going to recognize myself in those pages. I thought I was going to see things that I remembered. And there was so much about the diary that I didn't recognize, and one of the main things is that I had remembered myself as being a pretty kind kid and kind of a nerdy kid, and the pages are just filled with my angst about where I fit in the social hierarchy and my determination to be popular.
And not as kind of nice a person as you thought you were, and that a little bit of that storyline appears in the new book?
I was not nice at all. The pages are just filled with insults about different kids, some who were my friends, some who I barely knew, my family members, my teachers. There are probably 100 full pages of writing, and in those 100 pages, I don't really have a kind word to say about anybody except whichever kid I happened to have a crush on at the time.
A couple things. First of all, you turned out to be a lovely person because we know
you.
And so the parents take heart with that, and young people take heart with that. But also, we see this play out in Caitlin, your main character, that she starts to discover, she wasn't exactly as nice as she thought she might have been. But before that, there is this Polly Fink, the mystery man. He's, elevated to God level. The kids adored him, but he's gone. So they find an old gym bag of his with a stinky T-shirt. It's got the slogan, pick a winner, and a picture of someone picking their nose. Are we in YA territory or what? They make a statue to him. They revere him. He becomes like the Greek gods they're studying in humanities class. Start sentences with, in the name of Polly Fink. What are you saying about what kids do to other kids?
Well, I think I'm also talking about all of us. We have this celebrity culture where we pick people and we elevate them, and we elevate them beyond the ordinary. We turn them into something extraordinary and by nature impossible. And they do this with Pauly after he leaves. Pauly was kind of a prankster in the class. He was able to pull pranks that were not unkind in nature, but he was very funny, and he did a lot of disrupting the rules himself. Mm-hmm. And so they just tell these stories about him, and he becomes bigger and bigger and bigger in their minds. And the stories aren't necessarily untrue, but they are selective. They're remembering some things about him. They're not remembering everything about him, which is sort of what we do with celebrities as well, and have done with celebrities since the beginning of time.
But the kids are studying, as we said, gods and goddesses. Talk more about, you know, that you keep tying this into the gods and goddesses and the humanities.
Yeah, so the kids are studying humanities, and they're learning about all kinds of things. They're learning about Plato and Plato's allegory of the cave, and the idea that what we see around us, what we're perceiving with our senses, with our own individual perspectives, may not reflect the full reality of the world.
Can I just tell you, when I first heard about Plato's cave, this idea that people are sitting in a cave and they're looking at all these figures on the wall across from them, and they just sit there and stare at all these shadows on the wall, and it turns out that it's people actually outside the cave running back and forth in front of a fire. They're completely missing life. Well, that's what television is. Plato's brilliant.
We see references to Plato's allegory of the cave over and over and over again in society. And because it actually was and continues to be kind of radical, because that idea that the way we are perceiving the world may not be the way it is a really hard thing to understand. The people who are sitting inside the cave with Plato's cave, they're seeing the shadows with their own eyes.
Right.
They're like, look, no, I see it. That's what it looks like. And they can't really understand that there's a reality that is bigger than their own perception. I find myself thinking about it all the time these days when I listen to conversations either in the political sphere or just anytime you see people who really are unable to step out of their own
cave.
Yeah, their own cave, their own perspective, and perceive that the world might be bigger and more complicated than they themselves can see.
Yeah. Well, so you have that as the young people are realizing maybe everything isn't what they think.
So the kids in the class, Caitlin is in this class where there are only 10 other kids in the class, and they are not very interested in her, understandably, because she's not actually very friendly to them. They're excited about her at first a little bit when they first meet her, and they quickly learn that, well, she's no Pauly Fink. She's not much fun. And they start telling these stories about Pauly, his best antics, all these different things that he did. And as they're doing this, they're kind of building a legend more than a real person. And after a while, they decide that there's this huge Pauly-sized hole in their classroom, and they have to fill it. They need somebody to step in and make things interesting, because it's not as interesting without him. So they decide to stage a reality TV-style competition, and they put Caitlin in charge. They say she's the only objective one. She didn't know him, so she can pick whoever is the winner of this competition. And she takes this job very, very reluctantly. But then she does get into it. The first challenge is a talk like Shakespeare challenge, because that's something that Pauly did. Just one day he went around, spoke like Shakespeare to his teachers and his classmates. And so all of the kids have to go home and memorize Shakespeare. They think of Shakespeare as somebody who is sort of stuffy and stodgy. And then they realize that he is just filled with these insults and these sort of great one-liners. And they get really into it.
Well, I'm going to be hurling some of these myself.
Okay.
You fusty nut, you quintessence of dust, my butt, you crusty botch of nature, you dull and muddy mottled rascal. What fun.
It was really fun. I'll say writing it was really fun. I was sitting alone in my office just cracking myself up with some of these.
The principal, Mrs. Gleebus.
Gleebus.
Interrupts lunch to announce classes are canceled because it's zucchini day and all the kids run out except Caitlin, who's like, what? And they start flinging zucchinis. I know that in Aroostook County in Maine, for instance, the kids get off to go pick potatoes. Is this a thing?
Well, I live in far western Massachusetts, and at the end of the summer, there's always way too much zucchini, and there is a town not far from me that does a zucchini festival, and there is, I mean, they paint zucchinis, they bake with zucchinis, there is a zucchini catapult contest, how far can you throw the zucchini? So I put that into the book just because I thought it was such a nice slice of rural life.
We don't want to give away the ending, just very poignant, very sweet. And you also managed to incorporate the Greek concepts of glory, sacrifice, and catharsis into this surprising ending. Why did you pull on Greek mythology?
I think I was really processing my own education. My education is very much steeped in what we think of as the dead white man canon, and I was trying to figure out what to do with it in this era. I was really thinking about all the voices that we have not heard. While I was writing this, I read Emily Wilson's translation of the Odyssey, and I found it really revelatory. She was seeing things in it that I had never seen in it before, and I thought, I think there's opportunity to reinterpret the ancient world for our modern times. Mm-hmm. And that was some of what I was trying to do with this book. It was really my processing of my own education mm-hmm. and the things I had learned about as a kid, trying to make them relevant to the world today and to the way I think today.
Yeah. Like having a kid who's elevated to God status tumble from the pedestal, but still be a lovelier person in there.
One of the last shots of the book, I won't say what it is, but we've sort of stepped away from this celebrity culture where we're elevating one person. And there's a moment that I knew long before I knew how we were going to get the book there. I knew that that was going to be the ending of the book.
Oh, fun. Well, I'm just grateful that there was no dissecting of frogs involved, which is all I remember from seventh grade. Ali Benjamin's new YA novel is The Next Great Polly Fink. Again, her first book, The Thing About Jellyfish, was a National Book Award finalist. So best of luck with this one. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
For the next installment of our series, Going to Waste, about how we deal with garbage, we're going to look at food that is thrown away. Each year, as much as 40% of food goes uneaten in the U.S., while millions in this country are food insecure. Well, Elkhart Community Schools in Indiana is hoping to make a dent in both of those problems. They're teaming up with Cultivate, a food rescue nonprofit that will take food that would have been thrown away and repackage it into meals for hungry students to take home on the weekends. Jim Conklin is president and co-founder of Cultivate. He joins us now. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Doing well. So tell us more about this food program and how it works.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not too much different than like your typical food bank, but the type of food that we rescue is already made and never served. So in some ways, it's actually more valuable food. We actually work with caterers and particularly this story, public schools. I think that's one of the things that really is resonating is a connection with the public schools. And then having food that we call rescue, actually going back to kids in the school system that you know, are food insecure.
So let's talk about, first of all, where exactly you get the food. You say you work with caterers in public schools. So give me an example.
Yeah, so in the public school example, Elkhart Community Schools, that's actually my hometown. So they are our first public school partner in this food rescue organization. But we also rescue food from the University of Notre Dame, a local event center called Century Center, a large catering company in our area called Nelson's Catering and Barbecue. In fact, we've been rescuing food way before we started with the school. But I think the rescuing from the school is what's really resonating with people in this story.
So give me an example. What would happen at the school? They serve lunch to the students. People don't eat the green beans or the potatoes or whatever, and then you go and get it?
Yeah, so, I mean, think about it from a school system point of view, right? They have to guess how many kids are going to show up that day, right? They always have to guess heavy, right? So we're actually rescuing the food that never goes out to the service line. Mm-hmm. And so as public consumers, we have no idea how much food is actually sitting in the background and never actually makes out to be served. So with the school system, we're focused on what we call the back of the house food that actually is never served. And that's
what kind
true
of food
with all
is it?
Of our so it's whatever is on the school menu, and, you know, and they build that menu, right, with certain kind of restrictions and certain kind of requirements that they do at the school level. So it will be unopened, unwrapped items sometimes, but also that hot food service item that's been prepared, but for whatever reason, maybe there were a lot of absentees or kids didn't like the pork tenderloin sandwich option, right, mm-hmm. and they didn't choose to eat that day. So when we rescue food from the University of Notre Dame, it's super good food that we're rescuing.
And if you didn't rescue it, it would just go into the landfill.
It is. And some, you know, stats, right, 21% of what we throw in our landfills is food waste. Mm-hmm. And when food waste decomposes, it creates methane gas. So we win twice here when we're able to rescue this food.
So tell me about the other end of this, the people who actually get this food. What did they think?
Yeah, it's so great. I mean, one of the great things was at Woodland Elementary in Elkhart, that was where our pilot program in Elkhart was. When the kids came back from the first weekend, the cafeteria workers wanted to convey to us how happy the kids were and the response. We've even had parents that made really great, you know, comments that it's so helpful to have a meal. And if we think about it, our schools do a great job feeding kids Monday through Friday. But there's this gap over the weekend where kids that are living, you know, in poverty or in food insecure situations, they don't get a complete meal right on Saturday and Sunday. And I think our program could be a solution to that.
Do you have a sense of how many students fall into that category in Elkhart?
Well, yeah, so we kind of look everything our nationwide, and Elkhart specifically, free and reduced lunch, is about 19,000. In our three-county area of St. Joe, Marshall, and Elkhart, that's kind of our footprint, it's about 43,000. Mm-hmm. Nationwide, it's 30 million.
Yeah.
Our school systems feed 56 million kids every single day. That's a lot of food that would be, I think, now is mostly thrown away.
So are these students eating the food that you're giving them over the weekend, even if maybe they're not eating it during the week?
Yeah, so what's kind of interesting is that, like I said, we have multiple food partners. So we tried to, the best we can, put in the kids' meals food items that we think they would prefer more. And sometimes it's not the food that we're actually getting from the school. It's food that we're getting from other sources. Unfortunately, we can't be sensitive to allergy concerns, no things, and there's a warning label because there's just too much variability in the food that we're giving. Mm-hmm. But we're trying to build meals that we think the kids would like to eat. So, for example, veggies, right? We're not going to put Brussels sprouts in a kid's meals backpack over the weekend. Probably going to be corn and green beans.
That is Jim Conklin, who is president and co-founder of Cultivate. That's a food rescue nonprofit in Indiana. Jim, great that you're doing what you're doing, and thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having us and sharing the story.
And we'll link you to more about it at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.